on this edition for Sunday, April 26th. The latest on the coronavirus pandemic. For some, the wait for life-saving elective surgeries may be over.
Hard times come, hard times go.
And the city of Louisville, Kentucky, with a new song for the times. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Walkenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
Consumer Cellular offers no-contract wireless plans that are designed to help you do more of the things you enjoy. Whether you're a talker, texter, browser, photographer, or a bit of everything, our U.S.-based customer service team is here to find a plan that fits you. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
It's day three of some reopening of non-essential businesses, and a week since Florida began allowing limited access to a few beaches. Here in New York City, where strict social distancing regulations are in effect, we are still working remotely. The coronavirus pandemic has taken more than 200,000 lives around the world. Hundreds of thousands of people in the United States have tested positive for COVID-19. This week, the U.S. government will begin processing another round of applications for more than $300 billion in new aid for small businesses and hospitals. Let's get started with today's top news. As states and local governments start to reopen, most are taking relatively small steps. But in some places, people are ignoring social distancing and other restrictions, like this salon in Dallas. The owner was sent a cease and desist letter and issued a citation by police. In Southern California, thousands gathered at beaches that are open to the public during the first heat wave of the year. On other beaches that remain closed, there were protests against stay-at-home orders. At a beach north of San Diego, three people were arrested yesterday when police said they refused warnings to leave. And beaches in Los Angeles County were kept off limits, even as daily high temperatures were recorded in the 80s and 90s. Health officials continue to push for increased testing for COVID-19 before public places and businesses reopen.
So right now, you know, we're doing about 1.5, 2 million per week. We probably should get up to twice that as we get into the next several weeks, and I think we will.
Dr. Deborah Birx, the Trump administration's coronavirus response coordinator, said there are signs the spread of the virus is slowing, but cautioned that restrictions will remain in place for months.
Social distancing will be with us through the summer to really ensure that we protect one another as we move through these phases.
States where reopening is already underway say they are following that phased approach.
The facts in our state are March 30th, we peaked in hospitalizations with 560 across the state. Today, we have 300 across the state in our hospitals. And so we think it's time for a measured reopening. But I've been very clear with Oklahomans that coronavirus is still in the United States and it's still in Oklahoma. So we have to continue with the social distancing, but we will start taking some measured reopening in a phased, measured approach.
Even with the phased reopening plans and the strict stay-at-home orders still in effect in many places, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin forecast an economic rebound as early as July.
I think as we begin to reopen the economy in May and June, you're going to see the economy really bounce back in July, August, September. And we are putting in an unprecedented amount of fiscal relief into the economy. You're seeing trillions of dollars that's making its way into the economy, and I think this is going to have a significant impact.
In Wuhan, China, the city where the global pandemic began, there are now no coronavirus patients in its hospitals. A Chinese health official announced today that the city also reported no new coronavirus infections. The virus is believed to have originated in a market in this city of more than 11 million people. Wuhan was also the first city to experience a strict lockdown in January when the health system became overwhelmed. Across all of China, officials reported only 11 new cases of coronavirus in the past 24 hours. In the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Boris Johnson plans to return to work tomorrow after recovering from coronavirus. Johnson was hospitalized for a week in early April, including 3 nights in intensive care. The UK continues to grapple with COVID-19. More than 20,000 people with the virus have died in hospitals in Britain, and the country remains under a lockdown that's ground much of the economy to a halt. And in Spain, some signs of life returning to normal. After 6 weeks of being cooped up inside under one of the strictest lockdowns in Europe, children came outside to play today. Kids under 14 are now allowed 1 hour of supervised outdoor activity within about a half mile of their homes. Children also must follow social distancing guidelines and are allowed to take only one toy each. Schools and playgrounds remain closed. Spain is one of the hardest hit countries in Europe, with the second most confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the world, behind only the United States. But the number of infections and deaths is slowing. Officials today reported that 288 people died in the last day, the lowest total in more than a month. There are continued questions about the health of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un today. Kim has not been seen in public since April 11th. A satellite photo analyzed by 38 North, a U.S.-based organization that monitors North Korea, reportedly shows a special train parked near a seaside compound Kim uses on the country's east coast. Questions about Kim began on April 15th when he did not attend a commemoration ceremony for the 108th birthday of his grandfather, Kim Il-sung. For continuing coverage of the global pandemic and all of the day's top news, visit pbs.org/newshour. One challenge facing hospitals during the pandemic? Deciding which patients have to wait for medical procedures they've been counting on to change their lives for the better. Now, as restrictions begin to loosen, some hospitals say they will begin rescheduling elective surgeries. But as NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker reports, an elective procedure doesn't mean that it is not a critical one. And postponement for some could be a matter of life and death.
27-year-old Melissa Siller started worrying about COVID-19 long before the U.S. had any known cases.
I was watching the trends in what was going on in countries like Italy, and I was very nervous.
As someone with a weakened immune system, Siller knew contracting the virus could be devastating. She was once a college tennis player, but 3 years ago she was diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. It's a group of genetic connective tissue disorders that left the ligaments in her spine too loose to support her head. She gets dizzy, loses her balance, has vision problems, and is in a lot of pain. But just this month, she was planning to get some relief.
So I was supposed to have a cervical spine fusion or a craniocervical fusion. So it fuses my skull and to a few of the vertebrae in my cervical spine. And because of the number of COVID cases in New York City, the hospital that I would be having the surgery at is really overflooded with COVID patients.
Siller found out late last month the surgery would be postponed indefinitely. That's because it's considered elective. Last month, the Surgeon General and the CDC urged hospitals to postpone or cancel non-emergency surgeries in preparation for a spike in COVID-19 patients. Across the country, procedures including organ transplants, joint replacements, even cancer surgeries were taken off many hospital schedules. A handful of states also included abortions on the list of temporarily restricted procedures.
We have really never been in this situation before where we've had to triage and think about which types of procedures need to get done first.
Dr. Jeffrey Matthews is the surgeon in chief at the University of Chicago Medicine. The hospital began delaying medical procedures in mid-March in order to open up ICU beds.
We really stopped doing things that we felt could wait, like joint replacement and a lot of other types of operation. Bariatric surgery was the other example I used. But then we started to think about, could we give alternative therapy that would buy us some time, say for cancer patients? There are many cancer patients who chemotherapy could come before surgery, and that might buy a few weeks or months to be able to get some time so that patients weren't coming into the hospital in the middle of the pandemic.
According to Matthews, surgeries at the University of Chicago Medicine are down 75%. To decide who does receive surgery, the hospital uses a newly devised scoring system in which it calculates factors including the size of a surgical team and how long a patient will be in the ICU.
What does this scoring system allow you to do as a doctor, and what does it allow the hospital to do as an organization?
So if we have room on the schedule, say for 10 or 15 of these medically necessary time-sensitive operations, I've got to figure out which ones is the orthopedic patient or the vascular surgery patient or the cardiac surgical patient or the gynecologic patient the one that needs to be done. So what the scoring system allows us to do is in an objective way and one that feels right across many different specialties and many types of patient situations, it seems to get the balance right.
We made the decision rather early on that we wanted to be able to continue to offer transplant to our patients most in need.
And what about life-saving surgeries? At Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, Dr. Sander Florman is still performing liver and kidney transplants.
For the patients that we're transplanting now, and that we wanted to continue to be able to transplant, their mortality risk without transplant is upwards of 80 or 90% at 1 month. So when you start to put it in that perspective, you start to get an understanding of why we were so committed to being able to still offer that.
In order to continue providing transplants, the hospital created a COVID-negative ICU. Patients are tested for the virus before they undergo a transplant. But there has been one change. For now, organs are coming almost exclusively from deceased donors.
We also made the decision that it probably wasn't right to do living donors, because while the recipients are willing to take a lot of risk, even unknown risk, didn't seem fair to put that on a donor, somebody who's completely healthy, doesn't need the operation, and is only doing it because they're trying to save someone's life.
The change means fewer organs are available. Across the U.S., transplants are down about 40%. As for using equipment to provide life-sustaining services for a transplant patient instead of someone with COVID-19?
We have not run out of ventilators here, so the idea that maybe we're using one of these ventilators for one of these patients and not offering it to somebody else isn't accurate.
Have you had to contemplate questions like this before, even in a theoretical sense?
Well, transplant surgeons and physicians are very used to life and death decision-making and having a shortage. Our world has always been about not having enough organs for those who are in need, right? There are 120,000 people in the United States waiting for an organ, and yet there will only be about 17,000 donors. And how to stratify that and how to accept that, how to discuss that with patients, how to know that half the people on your list waiting for a kidney will die before they ever get the opportunity is something we've always lived with. This is just adding on top of that.
The kind of life and death decisions that are routine in transplant cases are suddenly being made across the board. One person facing it is a friend of Melissa Siller's, Rachel Wilson. She was once a thriving ballet and lyrical dancer before her diagnosis. In fact, the two met in an online support group for people battling Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
My case has somewhat been elevated just within the past few days.
Just a few weeks ago, Wilson was stable enough to wait while her doctors decided the best course of treatment for her disorder. But in recent days, a related condition has caused excessive fluid to build up in her brain, putting pressure on her neurological system.
I'm having a lot of seizures. I'm not able to walk properly or much at all. Actually, I need a lot of help walking. I'm having vision loss, which is another, you know, neurological type thing. I'm pretty much everything. You know, another one is not being able to remember things. So it's very difficult to, you know, live any type of life.
Wilson lives in Northern Kentucky. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, she was traveling to the Washington, D.C. area to see specialists who treat her condition. But those doctors can't see her now, though her condition has become life-threatening.
My doctors are basically working really hard, but they can't do the surgeries right now because the hospitals are so full of coronavirus patients that they're pretty much saying, you know, you just have to wait, and in the meantime, we're searching for someone that might be local.
As she waits for her own surgery, Melissa Siller says she's relying on Wilson's encouragement to help keep her spirits up.
Rachel is one of my biggest supporters, and other people with our condition. We all support each other, and that sort of gives us hope. And I know for some of us, we've just been praying and hoping for a change, and hoping that the virus doesn't last much longer and that nothing happens to us before, you know, it's too late.
Back in March, as we were beginning to experience the steep rise of coronavirus cases, we spoke with Dr. Alexis Langsfield, who was just about to leave her family for several weeks to work with COVID-19 patients at a New York City hospital. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Carla Murthy checked in with Dr. Langsfield again. She's speaking from personal experience and does not speak on behalf of her institution.
So the last time we spoke, you were dealing with a lack of personal protective equipment. What's the situation now?
I know everyone has a different perspective and had a different experience on this, but you know, I'm a doctor in the emergency department, and all of our doctors and nurses had really good PPE. We all feel really lucky and really grateful that everybody put our safety first.
Can you describe what it's like to physically wear this protective equipment and do your job? How has it affected the way you do your job?
So when I'm dressed in my PPE, I'm wearing a big mask, which is extremely tight on my face. You can see now I'm wearing a like a bandage, a silicone bandage, which protects my nose because I was getting a pressure sore. And it's tight all the way around your face. And then over top of that, you wear a regular surgical mask. And then you have, I wear like a small pair of safety goggles, which are close to my eyes and protect from any particulate getting into my eyes. And then I wear a face shield. And between all of those layers, being able to actually see somebody's face through the reflections and being able to hear their voice and be able to see their eyes. I mean, I literally now have my name written across the top of my visor and try and make sure that my ID is showing, because people can't even tell it's me. The one other thing that's really hard for me is that the one thing that compromises my mask is if I smile too big. And I like to smile. So if I smile, I compromise my mask and my safety. But I often see people looking at me like, what's under there? You know, it takes away a lot of the humanity of our interaction. It's so hard because I can't give them any of the visual cues of reassurance.
Now that hospitalizations are leveling off, what is your biggest concern now?
Now everyone's saying, oh, look, it's slowing down. It's getting better. It's getting better. But our tremendous fear is that this is not one curve up and down that we're trying to flatten, but that we're actually going to see a sine wave. And the whole point was to enable us to be able to have the facilities and the capacity within the hospital system to be able to take care of all of those people along that wave without having one spike that devastates our entire healthcare system. But that sine wave is just going to be a tremendous load on all the healthcare providers.
When we last spoke, you were leaving your family behind and you were going to go pick up more shifts at the hospital. You weren't sure when you were going to see them again. Have you been able to reconnect?
I have. We had a long 3-week stretch. I've never been away from them for that long. And when I arrived back, it was just an awesome, wonderful, sweet reunion. And seeing them again was just perfect. And then leaving again was impossible. It has been so hard in so many ways going through this pandemic, but it's also the community around me, like my neighborhood, people have been rising to such extraordinary heights. Like I'm brought to tears every night at 7 o'clock when people cheer and bang pots out the window. I'm gonna cry just talking about it. And people have brought me chicken or roasted vegetables, or people got together and they made us surgical caps. It's been really awesome to see how everyone's come together. So thank you to everyone who's been supporting us. It really means a lot to all of us.
Have you been experiencing vivid dreams during coronavirus lockdown? Send your stories and videos to nhweekend@wnet.org. We may use some online or on our broadcast. With so many people sheltering at home and so much uncertainty about what lies ahead, city leaders are looking for ways to buoy community spirits. The mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, thought music could help. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker has more.
When Kentucky started staying home, the Louisville Orchestra conductor Teddy Abrams thought for the first time in a long time, he would have some time.
I basically had one day where I thought, well, I guess I'm going to have a lot of time on my hands now, and which has never happened in my life. And then the mayor called.
Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher was calling Abrams in the hopes he might lead a city initiative designed to keep spirits high during these uncertain times, called Lift Up Lou.
And he said he wanted a Louisville song. Said, you figure out how to do that, but can you come up with a song that shows off the talent of our city and the diversity of our city and really has a positive message because we need it right now?
Abrams agreed and then sent off emails to members of the Louisville music community. But then he says he wasn't sure what to do next.
And then I came back home from a bike ride and I went straight to the piano and just said, I need to come up with something. And I just played the piano track pretty much straight through. I don't really know. It just must have been the right combination of ingredients outside that day, and all the musicians got that so that they could start conceiving how they'd add to it.
Abrams sent this piano track to an eclectic mix of 29 Louisville musicians, members of the orchestra, bluegrass fiddle players, a beatboxer, and rock musicians, to work on the instrumentals. Meanwhile, an equally diverse group got to work on the lyrics. Jim James of My Morning Jacket, Scott Carney of the band Wax Fang, rapper Jacory 1200 Arthur, and Will Oldham, also known as Bonnie Prince Billy.
Teddy sent some music to start with, and then Scott Carney sent a big, like, chunk of lyrics. And so I kind of distilled a few things, rephrased a few things, and then stuck in the chorus, and then Jim sang it.
Hard times come, hard times go. The hardest things to understand are the new and the unknown.
The musicians composed and recorded their parts from home, sending a file to Abrams' co-producer Ben Soli, who put together the full track. After that, they all recorded videos, which were then assembled into one complete performance.
It's only for now, it's not forever.
The sound of Louisville that you hear in there is that there's kind of an effortless an eagerness to getting together and feeding off of each other and giving to each other.
You have all sorts of different genres represented in this 1 5-6 minute piece of music. You have strings provided by the Louisville Orchestra. You have Teddy Abrams, a virtuoso, playing piano. You have Jim James singing, Bonnie Prince Billy. You have myself emceeing, rapping.
What would happen if our people banded? No one left, no one stranded. Even though we feeling so abandoned, let's take a minute to make the moment candid. One time for the front line, extra daughter or son time.
How did you approach writing this verse? First of all, thinking about the theme, and then second, thinking about where it was appearing in the song.
So from me as a Black American who descends from slavery, who is the most impacted group of this pandemic, my ancestors used to sing spirituals to reflect the sorrow, but also give hope for tomorrow. So when I write music, it's in my DNA, and I use it to reflect the times that we're going through at that moment, and this song was no different.
New start for those who've done time. No time to play this week. No time to say this sweet. Everybody stay away 6 feet. Otherwise, we might lay 6 feet. We gon' need y'all to get ready. We need each other when the day comes. Lift up my city like Teddy.
And this is how the song Lift Up Louisville came to be, just a few weeks after Abrams' bike ride. The song will be released worldwide tomorrow. All proceeds from its sale will go to the city's response fund. But outside of the financial contribution, Teddy Abrams believes the song will do much more.
This is a document of this time. We are all experiencing this, obviously, simultaneously as a world. And I think we've always looked to our artists to put down the markers that we then use to understand history. And if we can represent the city in some way and say, here's how Louisville dealt with it, and here's what we were thinking at this time, then that will have been its important accomplishment.
You're gonna make it too.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.